They stood on the floor of an enormous vault at the very roots of the mountains. Quentin stared wide-eyed like a child, blinking in utter disbelief. The magnificence of the chamber was beyond his ability to form words to give utterance to his thoughts. Tully, too, stood by him in mute wonder at the splendor of the subterranean treasury. For treasure it was. Inchkeith had shouted for joy and gambled like a kid down the long, winding ledge where they had entered the vault. He still darted here and there, examining first one kind of ore formation and then another.
What was it you said about some sort of collapse at the main entrance?
What was that? Oh, yes. I found the main entrance to this room, this castle, with no trouble. Our path led straight to it, but it was blocked by a fall of stone.
Derwin turned around, searching for the entrance, spied it, and pointed out across the expanse toward an opposite wall.
There. See all that rubble? It is there the entrance lies.
Quentin saw a tumbled mass of rock slabs and boulders, some as big as houses. It looked as if the tunnel had collapsed.
What happened there?
I can only guess, of course, but I imagine the Auriga blocked it off for some reason. They were far too skillful as miners to have allowed such a catastrophe to happen accidentally. I think they intended it. There came a time when they decided to close off this particular part of the mine.
This part? This is where the Lanthanil is.
So it is. They had a reason for it, of that you can be certain. What that reason was, I cannot say, any more than I can say how the Auriga vanished, or where they went. But leave it they did. For us to find.
But it would have taken years to dig through that confusion at the entrance. What made you think there would be another way in?
I do not think they determined to keep everyone out. Just the curious. The fortune hunters and desecrators.
I would never have thought of trying that hole in the wall. It looked like a drop to certain death to me. How did you think of it?
I do not know. But if you believe that it was meant for us to find it, then we would have found it in any case. If the Most High had so wished, the mountains would have opened up before us.
Tully had been scraping around the mounds of stone that sloped up from the floor, and he came gliding back to where Derwin and Quentin were talking.
Come with me! I have found something!
As they rounded the heap of stone, Tully pointed to something which shimmered in the glowing light of the cavern.
What is it?
I think it is an anvil.
An anvil like none I have ever seen.
That is because it is gold. And look at these!
The Jair stooped and began picking up objects from the floor, where they were arrayed as if waiting for the master to return and take up his work once more.
Let me see those.
Inchkeith pushed in and took two strange-looking objects from Tully. He turned them over in his hands and tested their heft.
What are they? Tools?
Exactly. But such tools! These are the tools of a great master craftsman! And they are made of gold, too! Imagine thinking so little of gold that you would make tools of it. They are a very old and unusual design, but I can readily perceive their purpose. And look, here is a hammer.
I recognize that at least. But it must be very heavy and much too soft for a hammer.
Quentin took the hammer from Inchkeith and tried it. The golden hammer was not as heavy as he expected. In fact, it was only slightly heavier than a hammer made of iron.
Lanthanil can be worked with tools of any kind. It is wonderfully malleable, but gold does not diminish its power. Gold is the only substance which does not transmit the power of the metal, and the Auriga no doubt used a secret alloy to strengthen the gold for use as hammer and anvil. Oh, it was foolish of me to have brought those.
Inchkeith gestured toward the pile of baggage that lay stacked on the floor a few paces away.
Between these and the forge yonder, we have everything we need.
The forge? I do not see a forge.
There, set in the wall. And mind you, it does not look like one of our forges. It is more like a shrine. But I can tell what use it had. 'Tis a forge.
Quentin felt very small and insignificant in the magnificent chamber. He turned his eyes once more toward its huge dome, glowing amber and green, and to the walls streaked with blue and violet veins, and to the floor suffused with red gold and rose. He felt like a thief in a king's treasury who might be caught at any moment and thrown out.
Now then, here are the tools and anvil. The forge is close by. We lack only the ore, and we can begin.
Derwin's words shook Quentin out of his reverie. He had forgotten all about their reason for coming, so taken was he with the otherworldly beauty of the Auriga vault.
Begin.
Yes, we have a sword to make. No, no, these will not do.
Derwin handed two shining green rocks back to Tolly, whose eyes sparkled as he looked at them.
Neither green nor amber nor blue, red, not even gold is suitable. Perhaps for chalices and utensils and the like, but not for the Jalakir. The shining one must be made from white lanthanil, for it is most rare and possesses the greatest power.
I wondered why so much of the precious rock lay about. It was the white the Araga prized most.
So it is. We will have to delve for it if we are to fashion a sword. For I have not seen a showing of white since we entered here.
Nor have I.
At Inchkeith's suggestion, they spread out, each to a different quarter, to search for a vein of white ore among all the rainbow traces of colored lanthanil. Inchkeith schooled them on what to look for and how to go about it, so that at the end of several hours' search, they were well acquainted with the methods of miners. But by the end of an entire day's search, they were no closer to having found a speck of the rare white ore. The next day's search brought nothing but sore fingers and knees to the miners. The day following it was the same. Quentin considered these periods of activity to be days, since they were bound on each side by intervals of rest, but how long in duration they were, he could not say. At the end of it, they sat before the small fire Tolly had made in a ring of stones, frustrated and longing for sleep.
This water tastes stale as a stone.
What was that?
Nothing.
You said something about the water. I think I would like to hear it again.
I said this water tastes as stale as stone.
I think you may be right. Very like stone.
What is so odd about that? We have been drinking this water for 2 days.
Yes, ever since we emptied the skins we brought in with us.
Where did you find them, Tolly?
Why, at the pool over there, just below where we entered. But it is safe enough. I tested it myself and found no ill effect. It is stale because it had been so long in the cave, away from sun and air.
Then the pool is not fed by a spring?
I should say not. If it were, perhaps the water would have a fresher taste.
Why the sudden interest in our water? We have been drinking it for 2 days, as Tolly says. It has brought no harm.
Take me to the pool, at once.
Tolly rose and led him off. Inchkeith and Quentin stared at one another, mystified.
Well, we might as well trail along after them as wait here. I'm ever amazed at the notions that hermit takes into his head. There'll be no sleep until he is satisfied, anyway.
When they caught up with them, Derwin and Tolly were down on hands and knees, peering into the ebony depths of a pool whose surface looked as hard and polished as black glass.
No, I cannot see anything. But I think we must try.
Try what?
I cannot be certain, but...
Out with it, you pesky hermit! What do you suspect?
Only this, and it is a forlorn guess that it would be very like the Araga to further conceal their prize in a way that did not altogether hinder discovery.
You think it is in the pool?
Perhaps. I did not say for a certain that it was.
Bah, this is seepage water. Nothing else. You'll find nothing down there.
Oh, do not be so sure. Have you seen any seepage or running water since we have entered the mine?
A little, of course.
Very little, sir. The Araga miners knew their craft far better than any miner living today. Water is a constant danger in a mine, but as you yourself have seen, no such hazard threatens this mine. The Araga had ingenious ways of disposing of it. Therefore, I am inclined to believe that this pool is here for a purpose.
Of a purpose or no, how do you propose to delve down there?
That I do not know.
It was clear that no one had any idea of how the mining operation might proceed.
There is only one way. I must go down there.
Tolly, there is no need. We will find another way.
What way would that be?
We could drain it, or...
You see, my way is best.
But...
No, I believe Tolly is right. His is the only way. I see no reason to talk about it any longer. We might as well get on with it, since no one feels like sleeping.
No, I will not hear of it, even if Derwin thinks it is the only way. If anyone must go, let it be me. It is supposed to be my sword, after all.
Think of what you are saying. Are you fit to swim and wield a pick underwater? With your arm? What could you do? Who of us better than Tolly? Inchkeith? Myself? No, Tolly is right. He is the only choice. Of all of us, he has the best chance of succeeding.
Then I will go with him.
You may be of some help. All right, let us begin.
Within a short time, they were ready. Tully and Quentin stripped off their clothes, and wearing only their leather baldricks, to which had been attached long ropes, tools, and, on an inspiration from Inchkeith, small pieces of glowing lanthanil so that they might be seen as they descended and worked in the inky depths. They stood on the brink, looking morosely into the pool as if Hoth himself waited below to embrace them in his icy grasp. Derwin and Inchkeith held the ends of the ropes.
"Remember, you have but to tug on the rope and we will pull you up in an instant. Do not try to swim. Save your energy and lungs. It will allow you to work longer. The weight of the tools you carry should take you down quickly enough. Save your strength, both of you."
Tully said nothing. His countenance had hardened into features as cold and unreadable as the stones of a castle wall. Whatever he felt inside had been pushed far back into some remote corner of his being.
"This is a brave thing you are doing, fair friend. Do not worry. I will be beside you."
Tully nodded briefly, never lifting his eyes from the pool. Then he took one step in and sank out of sight. Quentin followed, clutching his injured arm to his chest so that it would not float awry. The shock of the icy water upon his bare skin almost caused Quentin to gasp at once. It felt like 10,000 dagger points tearing at his flesh. He swallowed air into his stomach, and bubbles spouted from his nose. An instant later, he was benumbed to the icy assault of the chilling water. He opened his eyes as he drifted down and down into the black, dreamlike void. He looked up to see the faintly luminescent glimmer of the cavern above as it receded and dimmed with his descent. Close beside him, Quentin could feel Tully's presence, though he could but faintly see his friend. At three spans or so below the surface of the water, they reached a sharp overhang and felt along this shelf-like projection with their feet, almost walking along it, until it dropped off again. Underneath the shelf was a great hollow, or that was the impression Quentin received, for he could see nothing at all. Even the dim glow above was now obliterated beneath the overhanging rock ledge. It was with some surprise that Quentin's feet touched smooth rock once more. Whether it was another rock ledge or the bottom of the pool, he could not tell. But here it was where Tully decided to begin searching for the elusive white ore. Quentin felt a slight swirl of movement beside him and knew that Tully was inching forward toward the wall, which he imagined was directly before them. Quentin made to follow and immediately stubbed his toes against a lump of rock. With grace and ease, he righted himself and weightlessly followed after Tully, whose belt of glowing lanthanil he could see just before him. Tully had reached the rock wall, and with a jarring bump, Quentin reached it too. They had only been underwater for a few moments, though already it seemed like hours to Quentin. He wondered how Tully was taking it. There was another swirl of movement. Quentin realized that Tully had wasted no time or motion, and was already picking away at the surface of the rock face with one of Inchkeith's handpicks. With his good hand, Quentin fumbled at his baldric for a tool and followed Tully's example. He picked blindly away with the slow, cushioned movements of the swimmer. After but a moment of this exertion, Quentin's lungs began to burn, and he reached out to signal to Tully that he was going up for air. Tully acknowledged his signal with one of his own. Quentin tugged on the rope and stepped back away from the rock wall. All at once, he began ascending rapidly, so much so that he had to kick furiously in order to avoid the overhanging shelf above.
"It is cold as ice down there."
"Could you see anything? What is down there?"
"There is a rock ledge, three or five spans below me here. Just under that is a space large enough for a man to stand and work. Whether it is the bottom or not, I cannot say. Tully is still there, but he should be up for air shortly."
"That sounds as good a place as any to begin looking."
"Tully is staying down too long."
Inchkeith still held Tully's rope, slack in his hands.
"I shall fetch him. He's been down there long enough."
"Yes, and go see what is keeping him. No need to overexert his lungs, even if he can swim like a fish."
Once below the rock ledge, Quentin could see the dimly shining belt of Tully just below. He pushed on as quickly as he could and approached his friend in long, weightless strides. Quentin felt in the water for Tully's shoulder, and touching it, turned the chair around. But Tully turned away again, and Quentin felt the swirl of motion. Tully was continuing with his picking. Quentin, becoming worried for his friend, thought to grab Tully's rope and tug it himself, and so get him hauled to the surface whether he wanted to go or not. As he reached out for the rope, he saw something out of the corner of his eye. He turned and saw a very faint, spidery crack appear in the rock wall, as if a shining web of delicate silken strands was glowing there. He took up his own pick and, following Tolly's lead, began chopping away at the rock before them, leaving Tolly to his own judgment. In a moment, the black wall of rock before them crumbled away with a flash of silver, and there before them, blazing like the sun with cold brilliance, opened a vein of white lanthanil, two hands wide. Quick as a snake, Tolly reached out and placed his hands on the radiant stone. Quentin saw, in the inundating glare which so suddenly shone forth, Tolly transformed. It seemed to Quentin, feeling so cold and unnatural in this watery grave of a place, that Tolly suddenly appeared larger, stronger, and more noble. Quentin had little time to wonder about what he saw, for Tolly was already hammering at the stone and breaking off a big chunk of the precious rock. Quentin had hardly blinked his eyes when Tolly offered him a huge piece of white shining ore. Quentin looked at it, strange in this underwater world, and at Tolly, who was grinning in spite of himself. Already, Quentin's lungs were beginning to burn again. It was time to surface. He wondered with amazement how Tolly could remain submerged for such a time. Quentin reached out to grasp the stone Tolly offered him, with no more thought than to take it up to the surface for Inchkeith and Derwent to see, to tell them they had found their treasure at last. But as Tolly tumbled the stone into his hands, Quentin felt a shock of heat pass through his body like a flame of ice. He tingled all over as if he had been struck by lightning, but the burning passed in an instant, leaving behind a warm glow of peace and well-being. Even the ache of his lungs vanished in that instant. He suddenly felt more alive and whole and at peace than ever in his life. In the very same moment, though Quentin was never really certain, for it all happened so fast, he felt a long shiver course through his right arm. The arm tingled as if needles pierced it all over. And then, deep within his arm, in his very bones, he felt a strange warmth that grew and grew until he thought his bones were on fire. He looked at Tolly in the weird shining light, and Tolly grinned knowingly back at him. He stretched out his hand to touch Tolly's face, and the hand obeyed him once again. The fingers flexed, and the arm swung freely, though encumbered somewhat by the splint still attached to it. Tolly broke off another piece from the vein of blazing ore and jerked his hand upward, signaling for them to rise. Quentin had quite forgotten they were underwater. The urge to return to the surface had vanished the instant he touched the stone. But now he was eager to show their find to the others. So, quite forgetting to tug on the ropes, they began swimming to the surface.
Inky! Bar my lights! Look there! It is the lanthanil! Praise be to the God Most High! We have found it! Ha ha!
Upon the straining backs of groaning slaves, Nin advanced along the old river road from Andalia on the western coast eastward toward Ascalon. 50,000 footmen followed in his train. The Arvin here ran bold and deep, and wide enough for those who could find boats, and even those who could not, to escape to the other side as Nin's terrible caravan passed by. He had sat in his palace ship waiting just beyond the island where the river mingled its waters with the bright Gerfalons. But his rage had flared and burned while he waited for word from his warlords that Ascalon had fallen. When it was not forthcoming, the supreme deity of the Ningal had decided to go himself and see to it that the end came swiftly. He ordered his standing army of 50,000 foot soldiers waiting in their ships to disembark upon the western coast, and then he had ordered his throne to be carried ashore. There, he mounted his throne over the prostrate bodies of his slaves, and with a wide, generous sweep of his hand, ordered them ahead. Like an army of locusts, they cut down everything standing in their path. Crops and fields, the hovels of peasants, small villages, nothing deterred them, and no one lifted a hand to prevent them. By night and by day they marched, tirelessly, relentlessly, inexorably, drawing nearer and nearer to Ascalon. By night and by day the evil wolf star shone in the heavens. By day it could be seen shining low on the horizon, a bright spot appearing as a tiny second sun. By night it nearly assumed the brightness of the sun itself, transforming night into an eerie, mocking reflection of the day just past. Unnatural shadows stood upon the land, birds fell silent in the trees, and animals huddled in the field uncertain whether to sleep or graze. The masses, crouching in temple courtyards and castle wards across the land, wailed with fear and covered their heads. And Nim marched on toward Ascalon.
Is there any word?
The king seemed composed and in his right mind, resting peacefully in his bed. Bjorkus and the queen stood by him, and the lords entered his chamber. Lord Rod, who had taken it upon himself to speak for the rest of the lords, approached the king's high bed.
Sire, we have had no word, and now the opportunity for such is gone. The warlords of Nin have surrounded the castle on all sides. They occupy the plain below the rock and have taken the town as well. They have, as yet, not dared to draw near the ramp, but that will come soon, I have no doubt. Ascalon is besieged.
So it has begun. I had hoped a messenger might come from the lords of the north to bring word of their decision to join us.
It is too late, I fear. Even if a messenger came now, he would not get through the enemy. But even so, the lords might still come.
Lord Rod glanced at his peers.
We would seek a boon, sire.
You shall have it. Ask and it is yours.
We would have you come speak to the knights and men, your majesty. There are rumors.
Rumors? Ah, yes. What are they? You need not fear to anger me. I know full well the rumors voiced about.
Rod looked nervously to the others for help.
Well, speak, man.
Some say that you are changed, sire. That you do not have the will to fight.
They say that I am insane. That is what you mean. Say it is so.
It is so, my lord.
Escavar made a move as if to leap out of bed.
Please, sire, stay abed but a little and regain your strength.
Listen to Bjorkus, my lord.
Alenia threw a dark, disapproving look at the unhappy lords, who made a move as if to withdraw at once.
No! Do not hinder me! I will go with my lords to speak to the soldiers. They must have no doubts nor harbor despair in their hearts for their king. I will show them I am neither ill nor afraid. Assemble the knights and the men in the inner ward. I will speak to them from the battlements of the inner curtain and will pass among them when I have spoken to quell their fears and apprehensions. They will see me and will know I am with them and will lead them.
The lords, anxious to be away from that room, bowed as one and rushed out to begin bringing their troops together. When they had gone, Bjorkus and Alenia came close to the king and helped him up.
You are so weak, my king.
Let me tell them you will come tomorrow. Rest just this night and you will feel stronger.
No, it cannot be. Tomorrow may be worlds away. I must go at once. The rumors must not be allowed to persist if I can stop them, for they would eat away my soldiers' hearts. A soldier needs his heart and soul if he is to fight for his homeland. I must go.
Leaning heavily on their arms, he stumbled toward the door. When they had reached it, Escavar squared his shoulders and raised his head.
I will walk alone.
When he had gone, Alenia turned to Bjorkus.
He should never have gone into battle, Bjorkus. He was just getting better. He exerted himself overmuch and has not recovered his strength, and oh, now I fear he never will. If Derwin were here, he would know what to do.
Yes, Derwin would know what to do, but he is not here. We will have to think what he would do in our place and then do it.
I'm sorry. I did not mean to belittle you. Your help has been most valuable. Just
say no more. I too wish Derwin were here. He has far more knowledge of the world and men than I. I have been too long on my mountain, removed from the ways of mortals, and I feel old and useless. Let us hope that Derwin will return soon.
Let us pray that he does.
Yes, my lady. By all means, let us pray that he does.
Escavar went out from the Eastern Tower and strode along the battlements in the cold, mocking light of the star. His great cloak swept like a huge dark wing after him, the silver dragon device glittering in the strange light. Thedo and Ronsart marched gravely by his side, and when they had reached the midpoint along the inner curtain battlements, Escavar stopped and looked down at the ranks of soldiers, which had been joined to hear him speak. As he looked down upon them, seeing their fearful faces turned upward to his, seeking strength there and wisdom and assurance, he felt very old and very tired. They were sapping him, and it was as if he felt his strength ebbing away, even as he gazed down upon them. He felt too tired, too used up to speak. But they were waiting, watching him. His men were watching and waiting for him to banish their fears. How could he do that when he could not banish his own? What words were there? What magic could make it happen? Without knowing what he would say, Escobar opened his mouth and began to speak, his voice falling down from on high like the voice of a god. He spoke and heard his voice echoing back into the small places of the inner ward. Murmurs arose in response to his words, and Escobar feared he had said something wrong, that he had run afoul of his own purpose. But he spoke on, oblivious to the words which tumbled from his mouth unbidden. The murmurs changed gradually to shouts, and then to cheers. As Escobar's last words died away, the inner ward yard erupted in acclaim. Then, suddenly, somehow, he, Escobar, was moving among the thronging soldiers, touching them and being touched by them. The Dragon King stood among his troops, bewildered by their cheers and high acclaim. He was humbled, realizing he did not know what he had said. He was gratified, knowing that his words had been the right ones. That sound had not been heard in Ascalon for 500 years.
So quickly does the night overtake the day.
The Ningal had brought a battering ram to the gates of Ascalon. The siege war had begun.
I can scarce believe it still.
Quentin was flexing his arm.
It is as if I had never been injured at all. Better, even. And look, the skin is not withered and the muscle is firm.
Tully was standing near as Derwin unwrapped the bandages and removed the splints.
I can well believe it. The stories of old were true ones. The Koan Navish still exist after all these years.
The two glowing lumps of rock shimmered like fiery white coals fresh from the fire as they lay beside the black pool. Derwin finished examining Quentin's arm and satisfied himself that indeed it was whole and healthy once more.
So it is! Your arm is fully healed most wondrously. If I had not set it myself, I would say that it was never broken. I see nothing now that would prevent you from lifting the Jalik here, do you?
With a thrill like the touch of a spark to the skin, Quentin remembered all his old misgivings, which he had succeeded in putting far out of his mind. In an instant, they all rushed back upon him like a flood, quenching his excitement of the moment. Something like fear grabbed him in his gut and squeezed with an iron grip.
Do you still think I'm the one?
Why do you fear? You have already chosen to follow the Most High. This is the way he has set for you. Do not turn away from it.
But the prophecy, it is...
You think that you will be alone? Is that it? Ha! You will not rid yourself of us that easily. We will be ever at your side. Do not think the Most High makes his servants tread only lonely paths. His ways are more clearly seen with the help of others of like spirit. He has given us to you as you have been given to us, that we might help each other. Take it, Quentin. It is for you.
Derwin threw out a hand toward the white stones, and Quentin slowly, reluctantly, bent toward them and picked them up.
Yes, I will take it. I will claim the Jalakir.
So saying, he lifted the stones high over his head, as if he already had a sword in his hands.
Inkith, let us begin. Time is drawing short. There is a sword to be made.
But when they looked around, Inchkeith was not to be seen. The sound of the ram against the gates thundered on and on. The outer wards were roiling in panic. Archers had mounted to the gatehouse barbican and were endeavoring to pick off the Ningal plying the massive battering ram against the drawn bridge of the castle. Occasionally, an arrow would strike home, and an enemy warrior would tumble off the narrow plank they had thrown over the chasm which divided the end of the ram from the castle. Despite this annoyance, the Ningal were not greatly hindered. They were protected by the ironclad roof over their implement, and any unlucky wretch who chanced to show himself too openly was replaced in a trice by another.
Call off the archers!
Thedo was gazing down from the battlements.
We may as well save our arrows. They are not going to prevail against that gate. No one ever has.
We could pour fire down upon them. That would get rid of them.
And it would also burn down our gates.
I do not think even fire would harm those gates. I could be wrong. Still, it would be better not to take an unnecessary chance.
The timbers of the gate shuddered with each massive blow, but held firm. Thedo turned away from the battlement, and Ronsard followed him.
Thedo, I would talk with you a while. Let us go inside where we may speak freely.
They strode to a near barbican and went inside, ascending to the higher platform of the round turret to look out over the plain and the city below. From that lofty vantage, they could see the better part of one side of the castle and a portion of a second side. The Ningal had indeed surrounded the castle on all sides, being most heavily deployed around the main gates and throughout the town. They had set fire to sections of the city, and the smoke swept up in black columns to streak the sky above.
It is an evil day. How is Escobar faring?
He is the same. No change.
Escobar had nearly collapsed when the sound of the ram commenced. It was as if each blow had been so aimed as to strike directly to the king's heart. It was only with difficulty that the two knights had led their sovereign away without the soldiers witnessing his fall. Upon gaining the security of the tower, they all but carried him to his chambers. Bjorkus and Alenia had been in attendance since then, and the knights had returned to watch through the day-bright night as the Ningal strove to batter down the doors.
Will he ride, do you think?
Why do you ask me? I've stood with him in battle enough times to know. We are under siege. Why does everyone insist upon talking about battlefields and riding? Forgive me, my friend. I am tired. I have not slept in 3 days that I can count. One cannot even tell day from night anymore. I am tired.
Go and rest. Let me take your watch. You yourself have said nothing will happen soon. Have something to eat and lay yourself down a little. You will feel better.
Yes, perhaps I should do that.
Thedo turned his eyes away toward the north.
They should be coming. They should have been here by now.
They will come. And do not forget that Quentin, Tolly, and Derwin are abroad. There is some errand that will make good. That I am certain.
So I believe. I only hope they are in time.
Thedo smiled briefly and gripped Ronsard by the shoulder.
Thank you. I will rest a bit as you suggest. It has been a long time since I endured a siege. I have forgotten my manners almost completely.
You have forgotten nothing, my friend. Now go, and I will send for you if anything changes.
When Thedo had gone, Ronsard settled himself against the stone crenellation of the turret. He looked long and hungrily to the north for the shining armies he hoped he would see riding to their rescue. But the far vista shimmered instead with the heat of the summer sun. Nothing moved out on the plain. Still, the knight watched and waited, and his thoughts became a prayer, turning toward the new god he had so recently elected to serve.
God Most High, I do not have the knowledge of your ways that others do, but if you need a strong sword, here I am. I know not how to pray in seemly words. I have never been a man of prayers, but I believe you helped me once, long ago. So I pray you will listen to me once again. Lead us against this terrible host which gathers at our gates and seeks to destroy us. And if it be my lot to die, so be it. But let me face the moment like a true knight and seek to save another's life before my own.
He prayed on, pouring out his heart as the words came to him, and would have continued to pray if not for the interruption.
The alarm!
Ronsard ran toward the stairs, and the new disaster that awaited him. They found Inchkeith huddled behind a hill of stone, not far away from the pool. All wondered at his odd behavior and hiding, and at the look of fear which twisted his features as he raised his eyes to meet them.
What is wrong, Inchkeith? Why did you disappear like that?
The Master Armorer peered at his discoverers with a distrustful look. His hands trembled as he worked up the nerve to speak.
Do not make me touch it! I beg you, sirs! Do not make me touch it!
This is very strange.
I think I know what ails him.
He is afraid to touch the blazing white lanthanil. He has seen its power and what it can do. He saw your arm healed, and he fears what it might do to him.
But certainly you are wrong here, Derwin. If anything, he shall rejoice and rush to take it in his hands, that he might be healed of his crippling deformity. So I would, and anyone else, I would think.
Would you? Think again. His twisted spine cripples him, yes. But he has lived his life with it and has come to accept it and himself for what he is. His spirit has risen above his physical limitations in the beauty of his craft. There is a strong pride in that.
To be healed? To be made strong and whole again? What can be the harm in that?
Quentin, have you ever had a flaw of some sort? A hurt that you carried with you? You cursed it and fretted over it and longed to cast it aside, and yet you secretly caressed it and held it close, lest it should somehow slip away. For that weakness was part of you. And however hateful it was, it defined you. You took strength from it. With it, you knew who you were. Without it, who could say what you would be?
Perhaps it is as you say, Derwin. When I was a child, I held many such childish flaws and weaknesses as virtues. But I put them away when I became a man.
Ah, yes. But your weaknesses were not of the same kinds as Inkeith's. His is not so easily put aside. How much more must he fear losing the thing, ugly as it is, that has given him such comfort all the long years of his life? It is no wonder that he shrinks away from the healing stones, for though he would give anything in his power to be made straight and strong, he would give much more to remain as he is.
Quentin turned to regard Inchkeith where he sat a little way off, still huddled and trembling. There were no words to describe the pitiful picture that met his gaze. Sadly, he turned away from it.
Go and ready yourselves for another dive. I will talk to him a little and convince him that whether he touches a stone or not, the decision is his. We will not think the less of him for refraining if that, in the end, is how he chooses. Go on now. We will come hence directly.
Quentin and Toli did as Derwin told them and returned to the pool.
Look how they shine, Toli.
Quentin knelt before the two lumps of glowing rock.
Have you ever seen anything like it? It is as if they burn with an inner fire. They should be hot to the touch, but they are cool.
They possess very great power. Of that there is no doubt. I understand now why the Auriga closed off the mine and concealed what was left of the white lanthanil in the pool. The temptation to wield such power must drive men mad.
I wonder what else the stone can do.
We shall see, Kenta. You have been chosen to carry the Shining One. You will find out.
In a moment, Derwin came, leading a sheepish Inchkeith toward them.
Very well. Shall we continue? We have much work to do and have only begun.
One moment, Derwin. Please, I would speak. I am ashamed of my behavior. And you would do a kindness to a foolish old man if you would wash it from your minds. I'm sorry to have embarrassed my friends so. I promise I will embarrass you no further.
Think no more on it, Master Inkeith. I assure you it is already forgotten, and you shall never hear of it from our lips again.
They all returned to work as before and threw themselves into their labors. The enervating force of the ore-bearing stones which Quentin and Toli brought up allowed the two divers to remain underwater for greater periods of time, and before long, a fair-sized pile of the shining stone was heaped beside the pool. When the heap had grown to the size of a pyramid half a man high, Inchkeith called a halt to the diving.
This is enough for our purpose, I believe. If this magic stone be similar to other ores I have worked, we should have enough to make a sword and a scabbard and chain too.
Quentin and Toli dragged themselves out of the frigid water and dried themselves. Inchkeith left them to hobble to the forge at the far end of the cavern.
Bring the lanthanil when you're ready. I will begin firing the crucible.
Filling Inchkeith's empty tool chest with ore, Quentin and Toli carried it to the forge, where, using fuel he had found neatly stored away beside the forge, Inchkeith had a fire roaring and ready. When Toli and Quentin had filled the crucible with ore, it was rendered into the fire, where a curious transformation took place. The stones did not crack and release their ore as the stones bearing copper and iron do. Instead, they very slowly melted away, like ice in the spring when plunged into running water. Using a long rod, Inchkeith poked and stirred the molten lanthanil, causing the impurities to flame into hot ash and ascend up the chimney of the furnace. With long tongs, he introduced new ore into the crucible and kept his ceaseless vigil at the fire, maintaining a constant temperature. This went on for many hours, during which the others watched and dozed and ate by turns. At last, Inchkeith pulled the crucible white hot from the flames and gingerly set it down.
Quickly now! Take up the forager's yoke and lend a hand! Step lively!
Quentin was nearest at hand and took up the tool Inchkeith had indicated, a long iron utensil with two handles and a circular bulge in the center. Inchkeith took the yoke and placed it over the crucible.
Quentin, take one of the handles!
Quentin did as he was told, and they proceeded to pour out the molten ore, now a shimmering pale blue like liquid silver, into four long narrow molds which Inchkeith had arranged along the floor. There remained a fair amount of the precious metal when the four molds were filled, so Inchkeith poured the rest into a sheet mold, and then they sat down to wait for the metal to cool. Waiting for the glowing lanthanil to cool was like waiting for an egg to hatch, but at last, the four molds were judged cool enough. Inchkeith took up a dipper of water and poured it over the still hot metal. He then broke apart the molds and, with tongs and heavy gloves on his hands, drew out four square rods, nearly 4 feet in length. The master armorer hopped to his anvil, took each rod and pierced one end. Then he joined the rods together by passing a rivet cut from the sheet of lanthanil he had made.
Now then, I have done all I may do. Derwin tells me you must do the rest, Quentin.
Me? You jest. I know as much about making a sword as I would know of making a tree.
Then it is time you learned. Come here.
Inchkeith held the rods and the tongs and indicated for Quentin to take them. Quentin stepped forward, looking to Derwin for approval. Derwin waved him on, and Quentin took the rods.
Now do not think for a moment that I will allow you to mar my greatest masterpiece, young sir. I will guide your hands even to the smallest movement. I will be your brain and your eyes, and you will do as I direct to the utmost. Do you understand?
Quentin nodded obediently, and they began to work. Under Inchkeith's watchful eye, he took hammer and tongs and began to braid the still malleable metal, one rod over the other in a tight, square braid. When he had finished the task, sweat was dripping from his face and his bare arms. He had long since stripped off his shirt and tunic and wore only his trousers.
You have then the strength of four blades, not just one. This is how the legendary blades of old were made. There is a tension in the twisting of the braid that is never undone. This tension is what makes the sword leap to the hand and sing in the air. No common blade forged of a rod and flattened can stand against it.
Quentin was so absorbed in his working, it seemed as if he walked in a dream. All his surroundings blurred, becoming faint and insubstantial as he worked on. His eyes had sight only for the flaming blue metal turning under his hands.
You're doing a master's job, sir! A master's job! If you were not spoken for, I would take you in and teach you the armorer's craft. You have the heart for it and the soul. I have seen how you look upon your work. You know what I'm talking about, eh?
It is true. I've never done anything like this. But it is as if I feel in my hands what the metal would have me do. And I do it, though you must take the credit there, for I would not begin to know what to do. Well, I lift the hammer and I see it fall. A voice says, "Strike here," and it is done.
Quentin lifted the core from the pool. Water slithered down its pale blue surface and slid back into the pool in shining beads.
It does not look like a sword yet.
Oh, it will. It will. The work is just begun. Now we will see how this metal works. Now will come the test.
Inchkeith and Quentin worked on and on, pausing to take a little food now and then, and to rest only in idle moments, though there were few of those. The blade was fired and retired. Each time it was scraped smooth and filed again and again with long, careful strokes. Inchkeith bent his face over the hot metal and directed Quentin's fingers here and there along the length, pointing out minute flaws that only he could see. If his young apprentice's strength and enthusiasm flagged, the old master's never did. With praise and threats and stubborn demands, Inchkeith challenged Quentin to better and higher work, at one point taking Quentin's hands in his own and guiding them over the blade to do the job that he knew must be done. And then it was finished.
Yes! It is finished! And it is a masterpiece!
Ha-ha! We have done it! We have done it!
Does this unseemly exhibition mean that you two have finished your labors at last?
Derwin stopped, and a look of reverent awe lit his eyes. Tolly, coming hard on his heels, stopped with his mouth agape.
Oh, it is. It is indeed a thing of fearsome beauty.
It is the Jalakir. It is the Shining One.
Quentin took it from the anvil and held it in his hand, lifting it toward heaven.
This is the Shining One of the Most High. Let it move as he alone directs. As I am his servant, let it be filled with his power, and let our enemies fly before its terrible fury.
So be it!
Derwin stepped up and brought out a vial from the leather pouch at his side.
I have kept this for this time. It is oil which has been blessed in Dekra. With it, I will anoint the blade of the Shining One.
Quentin held the sword across the palms of both hands as Derwin opened the vial and poured the holy oil along the length of the blade, which shone with a pale, silvery blue light. The sword was indeed a thing of dread beauty. It was long and thin, tapering almost imperceptibly along its smooth, flawless length to a gleaming point. The grip and hilt sparkled as if cut from gemstone. As Derwin poured out the oil, he blessed the sword.
Never in malice, never in hate, never in evil shall this blade be raised, but in righteousness and justice forever shall it shine.
As he touched the shining metal, Derwin felt the power of the lanthanil flow through him, and it was as if the years fell away from him. He was a young man again, and marveled at the sensation, for he had quite gotten used to his numerous aches and pains. When he turned to the others, he was the same Derwin as before, but vastly changed in aspect. He appeared wise, stronger, and more noble than before.
Look there, Inchkeith, my friend. The blade has worked its enchantment upon you as well, I see.
What are you talking about? I never touched the stone nor the blade. What do you mean?
Quentin looked at the hunchbacked armorer and saw that he was standing erect and tall. He seemed to have grown several inches.
Yes. You are healed, Inchkeith. You are whole.
Your God has done this, Derwin. I believe now. I believe all you've ever told me about him. Blessed is the Most High. From now on, I am his servant.
When Ronsard arrived at the gatehouse barbican, he was met by the worried glances of his officers and Lord Rudd.
What is it? What is the alarm? I ordered it. Look down there. They're bringing some machine up the ramp.
Ronsard looked down and saw that what Rudd said was quite true. 200 or more Ningal were laboring with ropes and poles to drag an enormous device up the ramp. The battering ram had been taken away, and this lumbering object was being wheeled with great exertion to assume its place before the gates.
What is it? I have never seen anything like it. I cannot say I have seen such a machine in war either, but I can tell you I do not like the look of it, whatever it is. Direct the archers to hinder them as much as possible. I have no doubt it would be better if it never reached the gates. I will fetch Bjorkus. I would have him look at it. Something tells me that thing down there belongs more to his kin than to ours.
Shortly, the Lord High Marshal was back at the battlements, dragging a blustering priest behind him.
What do you make of that?
It is a strange thing indeed. Very strange.
Bjorkus's old eyes gazed upon the massive black object, inching its way up the long incline under a hail of arrows. Its black skin shone with a dull luster in the sunlight, and two great arms thrust forward, pointed upward as if to receive the supplications of the castle dwellers. It stood with the legs and torso of a man, one leg thrust forward, bent at the knee, the other stretched straight behind. but its face and head were its most distinguishing features, next to its size, for it bore the head and mane of a lion and the gaping maw of a jackal, with a jackal's sharp fangs bared in a furious, frozen snarl of rage. Two huge black horns swept out from either side of its hideous black head, and its unblinking eyes stared angrily ahead as it groomed forward under its immense weight.
Well, what say you, Beorcus?
Undoubtedly it is an idol of some sort, but to which god I am not certain. It is evil. It breeds evil.
But does it have any power?
Beorcus looked at Ronsard oddly.
You know what I mean. Of itself, is it a thing of power?
That I cannot say with certainty. Your question is perhaps more difficult than you know. An idol is but wood or stone. It is the image of the god it represents. Images do not often have power, except for the ones who worship them, and then the power can be very great indeed.
This one has power.
Ronsard and Beorcus turned to see Mirmior standing behind them.
And yes, it is evil. Well, I know it, for I have seen it work often enough. It is an idol, yes, but its purpose is far more coldly cunning than you suspect. It is foremost a machine of war, known in other lands as Pirin Bradan, Fire Breather.
If that is true, I will order Watt to be brought up at once.
It would be wise. Wet skins, if you have them, might offer some protection.
Is there nothing else that may be done?
Nothing but wait. Wait and pray.